Persons listening to this show should experience varying degrees of euphoria and might radiate a warm glow of truth from their entire being. This phenomenon sometimes lasts hours after a typical brain massage. If you are listening with another Lights On listener and they begin to glow, don't be concerned. This is a phenomenon normally associated with Pastor Scheidbach's patented brain massage technique and merely means the truth has set them free. Devil beware. Pastor Scheidbach is on the air.
Well, hello, I'm Jerry Scheidbach, brain masseur. It is time for your brain massage.
Truth, served here, flavored by delectable wit, delicious sarcasm, succulent sagacity, a gourmet meal for the mind.
What have we learned from the sequester debate, and what is going down in the GOP with Nicole Wallace, Meg Whitman, considered by many to be some big-name Republicans, together with some other prominent movers and shakers in the grand old party, coming out in favor of gay marriage, siding with those who are trying to overturn Proposition 8 here in good old California. Now, all this has been developing for quite a while. The GOP has been, evolving, I think that's the word Nicole used, in their position on these issues. Of course, I've been talking to this for quite a while. I've been sounding the alarm to my Christian conservative coalition, just made that up, my fellow God and country patriots, as a faithful member of the Black Robed Regiment. I have dutifully taken the sword of the spirit into the battleground of public debate, just as my forebears did in this country, by the way. Excuse me, just for a moment, while I speak to my colleagues. Do you know that every issue of liberty we cherish today, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of conscience, even our conception of the separation of powers, the idea of inalienable rights endowed to us by our Creator, all of that was preached from pulpits. You can find sermons all before 1763 that were preached on those topics. Did you know that America's pulpits routinely addressed current issues back then? Whether it would be elections or government policy issues, you name it. If it was in the news, it was addressed in the pulpits. Today, most preachers have either taken a seat at Jezebel's table, which is a way of saying they have joined the forces at work against our Christian conservative roots in order to garner favor with the world and from the world, or they're hiding in the caves, afraid to speak out, afraid to fulfill their duty to speak to the conscience of the king. Many of my friends complain that the world has made the American pulpit irrelevant, but I respond, not so. It's you, my brothers, who have made it irrelevant. You have betrayed your calling to be salt and light. You have fed yourselves and not the flock. You have surrendered to the world without a fight. And although it's true that some may be ignorant, ignorance does not justify laziness or cowardice. Some have believed the seducing spirits that teach devilish doctrines such as, the church has nothing to say about political issues, or this bit about separation of church and state means preachers ought not to speak to those issues, and they ought to limit their labors to matters unrelated to the affairs of state or to policies of government. As if the Bible has nothing to say about things like gun control, for example, or abortion, or homosexuality, or lying politicians, or the rule of law. When, as a matter of fact, Jesus, King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and Prince of the Rulers of the Earth, to whom is now given all power in heaven and in earth, has specifically charged us to teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever he has commanded us. Yeah. We are sent into this world as ambassadors of Christ, the King of heaven and earth, to declare to all men throughout the world the divine command to repent and believe on Jesus the Lord, to bow their knee to the Lord of the earth, Jesus Christ, and to give allegiance to him and his laws. That's what we're supposed to be doing. And that's what our founders understood. Some of them even, pining for the day when every knee would bow and every scepter turned over, of every nation of the world turned over to Jesus Christ. Look, let me get on with the show. What have we learned? Well, in the course of the debate over the sequester, certain facts have emerged. And let's do a little bit of review here and clarification. The meaning of the word sequester, for example. Well, what an obfuscation this whole thing has been. Anyway, I've tried to help you understand that. The word sequester means to isolate, to set aside, to separate, or hide away. It has a technical legal meaning. And when it's used in a legal sense, it refers to assets that are taken away by a government authority and held until a debt is paid or other conditions have been met. And when you're talking about legally taking assets, you mean that they've been removed from the original owner or the power of the steward and yet it's been removed by force of law, with the idea that they would be returned when certain demands are met or conditions are met. And in the case of Obama's sequester, and it was Obama's sequester, it has a somewhat convoluted meaning, which shouldn't surprise us. Congress controls spending now. We know that. Wow, that's funny. there's a oxymoronic statement, if I've ever heard one. Congress controls spending. But anyway, you know what I mean. They have the power or the authority to control spending. Now, here is what has happened. Because the liberals and the conservatives could not get together and agree on a budget, in order to get the Congress to go ahead and allow the government to continue spending until they could get an agreement on spending, Obama said, look, how about we create an agreement that says, all right, if you don't come up with agreement, if the conservatives and liberals cannot hammer out an agreed-to budget by March 1st, 2013, then certain automatic reductions in the rate of spending increases would go into effect by force of law. And that's the whole idea of the sequester. Now, the second thing we've learned is that Obama is the one who suggested this idea to Boehner, and both conservatives and liberals agreed to it as a way to end a deadlock over raising the debt limit back then. All right, now the third thing we've learned is what many of us knew all along. And that is that Obama never intended seriously to negotiate a reasonable, balanced approach to addressing the nation's deficit. He already got a tax increase on those making over $400,000 a year. And in fact, truly, his policies have led to a tax increase on about 80% of the American public. And Americans are beginning to feel it. Here's a liberal, I think they posted on Facebook or something like that, who complained about the fact that his Social Security withholdings went up. Now listen to this. Quote, what happened that my Social Security withholdings in my paycheck just went up? My paycheck just went down by an amount that I don't feel comfortable with. And he goes on to say, I guarantee this decrease is going to hurt me more than the increase in income taxes will hurt those making over 400 grand. What happened, end quote. Yeah, little wake-up call for some of these guys who voted for Obama. Here's some more, posted by someone identifying themselves as Romney Lies. How ironic. Quote, I know to expect between $93 and $94 less in my paycheck on the 15th, end quote. Here's from somebody who identifies themselves as Democrat to the end. Quote, my boyfriend has had a lot of expenses and is feeling squeezed right now, and having his paycheck shrink really didn't help, end quote. Here's from someone identifying themselves as Blue Indy Blue. Quote, many of my friends didn't realize it either. Our payroll department didn't do a good job of explaining the coming changes, end quote. All surprised about this, you see. So allow me to explain what happened. You see, coming into the election, Obama enacted a temporary hold on certain payroll taxes, which dropped the rate from what would have been 6.2 to an effective 4.2%. And this has kept the withholdings down in their paychecks. And it was part of his plan to spur the economy and all that, remember? It was actually his plan to ensure his re-election program. But that's another story. So now that his re-election is secured, and this temporary reduction is timed out, and just about every American who has a job, 80% or more, is noticing their paycheck is less now than it was. Some Obama dupes are beginning to wake up. Okay, perhaps we can hope for change after all. Some liberals are trying to deal with it. They're talking among themselves, attempting to reassure themselves and one another. Here's a fella identified as Bake. Quote, my paycheck just went down. So did my wife's. This hurts us. But everybody says it's a good thing. So I guess we just suck it up and get used to it. I call it a tax increase on the middle class. I wonder what they call it. Somebody on this thread called it a premium. Nope, it's a tax. And it just went up, end quote. Some of these guys got their pencils out and did some ciphering, and a few noted that this amounts to about an average of $86 per month for most people that they're going to lose in their take-home pay. You see, they're beginning to feel it. Here's Honeycomb, 8. Quote, $86 a month is a lot. That would pay for groceries for a week, as someone said. More than what I pay for parking every month after my employer's contribution to that. A new computer after a year, a new quality pair of shoes every month, months of my copay for my hormones, a new thick coat on sale or a discount place. It would pay for what I spend on my dogs every month, food, vitamins, treats, end quote. And then how about those students, by the way, with student loans that almost universally voted for the Obamster? Meet Virginia, who tweeted, quote, really, how am I ever supposed to pay off my student loans if my already small paycheck keeps getting smaller? Help a sister out, Obama, end quote. Here's another tweeter whose name I'll not mention, mostly because the idiot actually used her name when she posted a tweet like this. Quote, bleeping Obama, bleep you. This taking out more taxes, bleep. Better bleeping help me out. Very upset to see my paycheck less today, end quote. One of Obama's voters was significantly more courteous and, well, gentlemanly, so I'll mention his name since he did. Alex said, quote, Obama, I did not vote for you so you could take away a lot of money from my checks, end quote. And another Obamster voter said, quote, I'm starting to regret voting for Obama, end quote. And here's another not-so-nice Obama voter who's really ticked off, quote, Obama is the biggest bleeping liar in the world. Why the bleep did I vote for him, end quote. And, you know, that if Republicans behaved the way Democrats do, you would be seeing an endless parade of GOP spokespersons out there saying things like Obama's tax increases are creating hardships on middle-class Americans and even lower-income Americans. Some are having to make choices between groceries and shoes. Some are wondering how they'll ever repay their school loans when the Obama tax hikes are shrinking their paychecks. Right? You know, right. Anyway, the point is that when Boehner says, Mr. President, you already got your tax increases, what he means is that, Mr. President, you've already got your tax increases. You see, that was part of the sequester deal. The agreement was that the GOP would allow portions of the Bush tax breaks to expire, and Obama, you give us some cuts in the growth of spending. The sequester was a way to offer a guarantee that these cuts would be agreed to, that they would come to some agreement to cut the rate of growth in spending. Well, now it's time for the Prez to pay up on his side of the bargain, and he's refusing to do it. He's welching, and he's changing the terms of the agreement. And in doing so, he's trying to perpetrate a fraud on the American public with all this scaremongering nonsense. You know, the GOP needs to understand they're not dealing with a gentleman in Obama. Obama is a Chicagoland thuggocrat who bullies anyone he can into submission or destruction. He's rather like these radical Muslim nutcases who say you got three choices. You submit to Allah, which means you Islam, or you pay the tax called the jizya, or you die. And in the political sense, you face political destruction. All right, I've got to take a break here. Hold on, folks. I will be right back.
Have you ever complained against the White House and the House of Congress for despising our laws, showing contempt for our Constitution, and turning their back on our founding values and beliefs? Does it seem the Lord has forsaken the people's houses? And by the way, how's your house doing? Perhaps there is another house you should think about, the house of God, the church, which according to Jesus is the pillar and ground of the truth. He told us not to forsake the house of God. Have you? How long has it been since your family gathered with God's people in his house? God can fix the White House and the House of Congress and your house too. But remember, he begins with his own house. Every great revival has begun with a return to the house of God. God will return to our houses when we return to His. Lighthouse Baptist Church invites you to join us in the house of God this Sunday. Call 805-347-9887 or go to santamarialighthouse.org for more information. Satan is called the dragon and prince of the power of the air. The devil beware. Pastor Scheinbach is on the air, swinging the sword of truth at the dragons of deceit, thrusting the blade of incisive insight into the belly of liberal lies, lies that blind men's mind in darkness. He wants to know if you have his back. Go to www.thebrainmassageshow.com and make your donation today, or mail it to Post Office Box 2803, Santa Maria, California, 93457. It's time for the Brain Massage Show. Here comes your host, Jerry Scheinbach.
Hello, I'm Jerry Scheinbach, Wayne Masseur, and Paul Revere's lantern lighter, lighting the lamps of the church belfry arch, signaling the enemies on the march, an enemy that would steal from us our liberty. Some things we learned from the sequester debate. We learned what it means. You can call in, ask for show number 407, and re-listen to the first segment of this show. We learned that Obama is the one who recommended the sequester deal, and that the GOP and Obama's bots all agreed to it. We learned that Obama never intended to negotiate a balanced approach to getting our deficit under control. Instead, he intended to attempt to use the sequester to make the Republicans look bad, to demagogue the thing, only it's turning around on him and it's beginning to make him look bad, a la the Woodward threat allegation and the Arne Duncan fiasco. Ranting about sequestration creating hardships already, saying, quote, there are literally teachers now who are getting pink slips, who are getting notices that they can't come back this fall, end quote, which has been proved to have been a lie. And more recently, the surprising willingness of the mainstream media to actually almost come right on out and call Obama's hand on some of these things, which he has grossly, and I might add, gauchely overplayed, by the way. Which brings us to the next thing we've learned from the sequester debate. Obama will say anything he thinks he needs to say to get his way, no matter how outrageous or how inaccurate. He has painted himself into a corner here, I think. I mean, he's gone about the whole country screaming, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. And his message has lost its traction. He's now spinning, he's in spinning wheels mode. And we'll have to wait and see if he drives off into a ditch. But, you say, what do you mean we learned this from the sequester debate? We already knew all this about President-elect Obama. I know. I'm just saying. We have also learned that Obama will do anything in his cage-fighting approach to politics. No holds barred type thing. Even allow hundreds. I think it was, 500? I heard another report that suggested thousands. I think it was 500 detainees being held on allegations of illegal border crossing, which is a rather mild way of putting it. ICE is furious over this. It was done because of fears of cutbacks coming from sequestration, they say, which had not even gone into effect yet. Go figure. Obama's out there saying criminals are going to be set out in the streets and someone lets 500 criminals go free. I suppose there's a connection there somewhere. And then there's this rumor that among these were cartel members, hey? And some who were operators in human trafficking. What is this about? So we know the chief thugocrat is actually not warning Americans of what could happen if sequestration goes into effect. Instead, it's beginning to look more and more like he's threatening Republicans, particularly it's his target. But he's also really threatening us of what he's going to do if we make any attempt to take control of his insatiable appetite for spending this country into bankruptcy. I mean, it's heating up, my friends. My prediction is that Obama's either going to crash and burn on this one, that this would be perhaps the sword he chooses to fall on, or he's going to suddenly get smart and back off. And there are some indications that's happening. I wonder if he thought that he was going to raise up a storm of protest from the streets against those rascally Republicans, that they would be out in force with pitchforks and torches and calling for Boehner's head and, another Occupy movement thing kind of stirred up. And he's not getting the sort of support, from that crowd that supports him that he anticipated. Now, but in any event, any way you look at it, Obama has overplayed his hand and thereby has greatly weakened his credibility and his ability to negotiate in the next big battle upcoming. That's March 27, when they begin to haggle again over the issue of raising the debt ceiling. Okay, enough of that for now. Next, is there any relationship between the morality of a people and their prosperity? Or in other words, can you divorce moral issues from economic ones? Can you separate those out? I mean, beyond the sort of connections between morals and economics that liberals accept. Like this one, rich people are evil greedy and poor people are righteous greedy. So that when the rich guy wants to keep what he has earned, that's greedy and immoral. But when the not rich, we'll just put it that way, want to feed their greed by taking away what the rich guy has earned, that's somehow moral. I mean, that sort of connection between morality and economics is understood by the left somehow in their weird, perverse way of thinking. And, when the poor use government to steal from the rich through their voting bloc power, that's moral. See, that's a moral thing to do. But of course, if the rich use the government to oppress the poor and enslave them into perpetual dependency upon the rich, well, now that's also moral. if you think like Obama, who is playing both sides of this to the same end. So beyond the idea that morality requires all people with a conscience to understand their obligation to surrender the fruits of their labor over into the control of Obama, is there otherwise any relationship between the morality of a nation and its economic prosperity? Well, if you talk to the founders, they believed there was certainly a relationship between morality and political felicity and economic prosperity. George Washington et al. Made statements to that effect. The Bible certainly teaches that economic prosperity for a people is closely connected with the morality of that people. And I'm going to preach a message on this point Sunday night at the Lighthouse, 6 p.m. Be there. But probably most who are familiar with the Bible have noticed how many times God connects material prosperity with obedience to his law and promises of economic problems to a people who forsake his law. Now, some question this because they look around and they notice how often it seems the wicked, and I mean truly wicked, people everyone would agree are wicked, how they seem to prosper all over the world. And by the way, this is something that is often addressed in the Bible. Why do the wicked prosper? It's a question asked often. You will be amazed when you hear the answer, because there is a clear, reasonable answer, and I'll be giving that answer Sunday night at 6 p.m. at the Lighthouse. Don't miss it. Right now, however, I simply want to address a development in the GOP that, unless it turns around, it's going to necessarily result in a split in that party, which many of us see coming anyway. Nicole and Meg and some other GOP chicks and dudes are coming out and openly saying that the GOP needs to go big tent. In my opinion, a big tent is for a circus. And that's what we're going to end up with. That's what you have in the DNC. You have big tent circus. And now the GOP wants to do the same thing. Many refer to Reagan mentioning or talking about and advocating the idea of a big tent. And they believe that unless they go big tent, they're never going to win another national election. I disagree with them entirely, but they're not listening to me. All right, let's enter into this conversation. First of all, when Reagan was talking about a big tent, he was running on a pro-life and pro-family platform. Nevertheless, if I could remember who it was I was talking to on the day that I heard Reagan talk about a big tent, his big tent theory, I would tell you to go ask him what I said on that day. In fact, there are four moments in Reagan's presidency. There are some things he did I disagree with, by the way. But there are four moments in Reagan's presidency where I really felt like he breached the hedge, or to put it another way, opened the door to what would enter in and finally undo all the really very good things he did for this country and for that party. And one of them is when he selected George Bush the first to be his running mate. I told my friends a bad move, that George Bush was a globalist and would renege on Reagan's tax policies and compromise Reagan's revolution. I was proved to be right later on. When he granted amnesty to illegal aliens, I said, bad move. I was going to set a precedent that was going to be very problematic for us in the future. I might throw in there his nomination of O'Connor to the court. And when he started talking about the big tent thing, I told my friend that would be the undoing of the GOP. That is what destroyed the DNC. It's going to result in everyone being welcome except some group, and in this case, it's going to be the Christians again. The Christians were big-tented out of the DNC, and they're going to be big-tented out of the GOP. Bible thump alert! Bible thump alert! Quote, an unjust man is an abomination to the just, and he that is upright in the way is abomination to the wicked, end quote. Proverbs 29:27. There's just a natural enmity there that you're not, it's just not going to work. Now, to understand the scripture, you'll have to understand the word just and the word wicked in the context of the Bible. That's a just man is defining the Bible. A wicked man is defining the Bible. They cannot abide one another. They will not. It is not possible. Listen, it's impossible to be inclusive of all groups anyway. Some group or subgroups going to be cut out of the herd. And the Big Ten approach used by the DNC has effectively cut, Christians, certainly Christians who believe in the biblical mores of the biblical principles of life and the issues on sexuality and all that. And it's going to do the same things to Christians in the GOP. For example, notice that these people who are talking about the Big Ten, notice what they're doing. They're saying that they are in favor of homosexual marriage. They're not saying homosexual marriage is not something we want to get involved in. They're not saying, just put that aside. They're not saying homosexual marriage is a moral issue that has nothing to do with being conservative or liberal. They're not saying that, there are conservative homosexuals, there are liberal homosexuals, so the issue is not one we want as a political party to be involved in. No, that's not what they're doing. They're saying that they intend to officially brand the GOP with the homosexual agenda, that they are reaching out to the homosexual community and saying, we are going to side with you against the conservatives in California and cut their legs out from under them, like they did with Meg a while back, and on the issue of abortion, and join the effort to encourage the Supreme Court to undermine the expressed will of the people of that state. In fact, Ms. Wallace went so far as to say, listen to this, that the real conservative position is that marriage is foundational to society and is a good thing. And so from her point of view, marriage of homosexuals would be therefore a good thing, because then children raised by homosexuals would at least grow up in a two-parent family. I kid you not. And it was obvious to me, I heard and saw this particular interview, and it was obvious to me when I heard this nonsense that A, she knew full well that she was sticking it to the conservative Christians in her party. She knew that. And she was driving a knife into the heart of that segment of her party, and enjoying it, by the way, enjoying it immensely. She, along with Dear Meg and the rest of the rhinos and some others, have long been seething in bitter resentment against the conservative Christians in the Republican Party for the resistance that we have expressed against them, especially bitter Meg when it comes to California. The second thing I noticed as I listened to Ms. Wallace explain her view of what it means to be really to be a conservative, saying being a true conservative means supporting gay marriage because, after all, marriage is a conservative thing. Yeah. it's this. Ms. Wallace is extraordinarily lacking in sound reasoning abilities or in common sense. Her syllogism runs something like this. Marriage is good. We are all agreed to that. Marriage is a conservative value, and we're all agreed to that. Well, then, if marriage is both good and conservative, then, hey, we should want homosexuals to get married, right? That's her reasoning. I hope you're not among the bobbleheads that fall for that kind of nonsense. Good night. I'll have some stats I'll share with you in our next show. I don't have time to go into right now that prove homosexual marriage actually increases the chances of all the health problems that go along with homosexuality, and that these unions do not provide a healthy, nurturing environment for children. But facts aside, you know, huh? Marriage is good, and therefore we should want homosexuals to have it. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's something we should support. Well, if that's true, then, well, here we go. Marriage is good. Doesn't necessarily follow, therefore, that any union that can be legally called marriage is desirable for society. I mean, so the union between Muhammad and his 9-year-old bride is a good thing, and so we should allow that kind of thing in our culture right now? I mean, after all, if we call it marriage, marriage is good. And so, therefore, a union between a, well, what was he, 60-something, 65-year-old man and a 9-year-old little girl, what's the problem? How about a union between a woman and her donkey, for that matter? I mean, if someone says, but that isn't a union that can reasonably be argued would be good for nurturing children. The whole homosexual thing about marriage is not about children, friends. But anyway, are you kidding? Of course it's not. And studies that show children growing up in homosexual homes are more likely to be dysfunctional. They don't concern these people in this debate. Why should you be concerned about a kid growing up with a mom and a horse? Anyway, I'm out of time for this show, but I do want to come back to this next week and really lay some things out for you that my research department provided for me. Oh, yeah. Thank you, Barb. And I want to talk to you about this shakeup that's brewing in the GOP and what Christians are going to have to do about this. I mean, you know, it's just like they were pushed out of the DNC. Listen, you're going to have to recognize that this nation isn't going to be saved by a political party. If it's going to be saved from being cast off into hell for forgetting God, it's going to be the result of a sweeping revival of biblical Christianity. I've lit the lamps in the Church Belfry Arch. Now you call and let me know you see that they are on. Call 1-888-770-8000. That's 1-888-770-8000. And leave me a message on our listener response hotline. Say lights on if you agree with me. Lights off if you disagree. God bless you. God save America. I'll see you in church.
If you're looking for unvarnished, plain Bible preaching that tells it like it is without fear or compromise, come to The Lighthouse, where we are shining the light of God's truth to help families navigate through the moral storms of our day. Call 347-9887 for more information.
For a complete brain massage experience, tune in Saturdays at 7:30 a.m. and go to www.thebrainmassageshow.com. The Brain Masseur is waiting to massage your brain with scintillating insights.